afternoon and welcome to another edition of Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM with Padre Greedy and me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is a show about rationalism, humanism, science and the left. If you're looking for superstition or the supernatural, I'd advise you to switch off now. Also, if you're looking for conspiracy theories, we're a bit light on that, but I would recommend highly that you hang around till 8 o'clock tonight for the David Chalier show for all your conspiracy theory needs. Our guest today is the sociologist, writer and broadcaster Laurie Taylor, who Padraig will now introduce.
As Neil said, Laurie Taylor is a sociologist and broadcaster. He presents Thinking Aloud on Radio 4, is commissioning editor of New Humanist magazine and a vice president of the Rationalist Association. Afternoon, Laurie.
Hi.
Maybe you could start by explaining to us what the Rationalist Association is and why you got involved, why you felt the need to get involved with rationalism.
Well, I suppose that after I'd said goodbye to Catholicism at sort of secondary school, I thought, well, that's all there needs to be, and I just hung around with people. I suppose I had the rather easygoing, complacent assumption that everybody I met and knew and who were friends were atheists and rationalists. So I didn't really ask them about it very much. It just seemed to me pretty common sense that we'd given up religion long ago, and the idea of a man in the sky who could see into our minds and resolve our sins for us and assure us happiness in the next life just was so absurd as not to bother. No conversation ever came up. And then I gradually became aware. I remember it was like the first dinner party I went to, and somebody sort of saying, by the way, you know, I'm feeling much better now. And I said, you know, why was that? And they said, well, you know, they'd been for a course in aromatherapy, you know. And I said, aromatherapy? You know, I mean, how do we, what is that? So they explained the complex chemistry of smells. And the longer they went on, I thought, this is complete, not a balderdash. This is total nonsense. What on earth are they talking about? And then I eventually said, I'm sorry, but I mean, empirically, I mean, you know, I mean, how do you justify this? Doesn't sort of make any sort of sense. What are we talking about here? And they said, well, no, it worked for me. And I suddenly realized I'd just come across New Age religions. I'd suddenly come across this whole basketful of nonsenses which people who I'd otherwise regarded as atheists and rationalists were suddenly picking up and running with. And I remember being appalled on two grounds. I mean, one was the sudden, I took an easygoing assumption that secularism was on the advance, that eventually, you know, the triumph of secularism was assured, and there might be some pockets of fundamentalism around, but soon, you know, everybody would abandon religion in the world and we could proceed to a rationalistic take on our social problems. But I suddenly realized two things appalled me about this. First, as an ex-Catholic, I was appalled at the complete incoherence of the systems I was being presented with. People started telling me about crystals and about the values of palmistry. I mean, you know, they might as well have started talking about phlogiston. Well, they might have started talking about phrenology. So there was this madness. I thought, God, at least by Catholicism, once you accepted the absurd, irrational parameters, within sight had a certain sort of, you know, structure of coherence. Things fitted together. In fact, you couldn't get out of the bloody maze of Catholicism, you know, once you were inside. But these people just picked these things up like it was like, you know, like pick and mix in Woolworth's supermarket. You know, they're a packet of licorice all sorts, which they call palmistry. You know, another packet of barley sugars, which they label. And there they were. And they used them all together. They conflated them. Mm-hmm. Certainly people would go into shops and sort of buy something which would help them with their aromatherapy and at the same time pick up a crystal. You know, it wasn't as though these systems were discrete. One said, I believe in just this one thing. These were people collecting all these things, hanging them like things around their neck. The T-shirt had all these signs on. So that was the one thing that appalled me. And as I said, the other was just simply the fact, God, what is going on here? What is going on in our society that people have decided to resort to these nonsenses?
Would you say that it's not clear-cut enough to say that these New Age type of religions have replaced the traditional religions? They still exist. But because there isn't, in the UK at least, the same sort of social pressure to adhere to the traditional monotheistic religions, would you say that the New Age religions have replaced them, or that the religion now is just is the same thing? It's just another pick and mix thing.
Well, I think that really that it's almost people who can't. This is a pompous thing to say, but it's almost, it seems to me, that the people who pick these up are people who can't effectively theorise their disenchantment with the contemporary world. I mean, there used to be ways of theorising your disenchantment with the material, consumerist, capitalist age. It was called Marxism, or it was called socialism, or it was called radicalism. But with, as it were, the disappearance or the attenuation of that ideology, when people wish to express any sort of disenchantment with their circumstances, when they thought my life is only full of material things, I don't seem to have any higher thoughts or anything that might stand in for spirituality, and when they looked around, that they began to pick up these toys and think that these might compensate for the occasional moments of transcendence that they had in between their shopping trips. So I don't think it's I mean, religion in a way was always a way of talking about, all religions are ways of talking about disenchantment with the here and now material world. I mean, whether or not it's the extreme promise of a better life for people who've got absolutely nothing in this life, or whether it's, as it were, to sate the appetites of slightly sort of bored bourgeois. But I mean, that's what it's being used for. But I just think now, you know, now that the people who pick it up are people who almost want some way to express dissatisfaction with the ways in which their lives are consumed by getting and spending, but they don't want anything which interferes with their lives of getting and spending. And subscription to many of the orthodox religions does suggest certain constraints upon your materialism, whereas these allow you to go on being as materialistic as ever. In fact, you can go out into the marketplace and buy your religion off the shelf, and many of these religions are bought off the shelf to hang round your neck or wear on your arm.
We're obviously talking about a particularly British circumstance here, because if you'd have been born in America, Laurie, even a member of the sort of West or East Coast sort of intelligentsia, I don't think you'd be sitting here saying, well, suddenly I was growing up and everybody I knew was quite clearly, obviously, an atheist. But also at the same time, that, you know, we could perhaps look at, When you mentioned about people not being able to find a way to sort of manifest their disenchantment with the modern world, if I can find a sensitive way of saying this, we can perhaps look at other religions, perhaps, you know, people who might be of the Muslim faith, for instance, who might suggest that they can, you know, show their disenchantment with the modern world by their religion. The difference between politics and religion in the Muslim faith is quite different. So are we talking about something that's particularly British or even European?
Well, I think, I mean, I don't think that in the Muslim world, you know, one wants to talk, as it were, you know, I mean, just, I don't think, I mean, there is, it's a failure to be enchanted by the world rather than a disenchantment, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is an assertion that we don't want to have that particular way of life. This is a rebellion before materialism arrives rather than a disenchantment following upon the arrival of materialism. So it's people saying, you know, we don't want the Americanization, we don't want the Coca-Colaization of the world, we don't want the values. I mean, I've just been finished reading Updike's book on terrorism, you know, the terrorist. And I think it's very clever. I mean, it's been attacked for...
It's got mixed reviews.
Yes, certainly. It's had very mixed reviews. But I think the way in which he sets out the world weariness of the character, who's not the Muslim in the character, but the world weariness of his life. I mean, it has slight touches, you know, that here he is, his life is meaningless, he can't quite understand why he's got up in the morning, what he's doing, it's all been a bit of a waste of time, the American dream didn't work. His story, which is more implicit than explicit, and then you've got the explicit statements being made by the Muslim boy, you know, about his feeling that the world, the materialism of the world is appalling, and the morals of the world are appalling, and the adultery and the drug taking and the and all of that. And I think Updike does a much cleverer job than some of the reviewers have noticed at saying, by the way, your disenchantment with the material world is not actually dissimilar. It's not so well articulated. Mm-hmm. It's not so well formulated. It doesn't have so many social consequences. But nevertheless, you know, there are extraordinary affinities. So you can read the book as a critique of capitalism and what capitalism does to those who, you know, who toil within its confines, from two points of view. One from a world-weary, disenchanted man, and the other from a sort of dogmatic, subscribing young man.
Yeah. Now, getting back to something you addressed earlier, you said we used to have Marxism to analyse our disenchantment. Is Marxism still a useful way? Is historical materialism still useful in analysing our place in the world? Do you think that it's relevant today?
Well, it is interesting. It's interesting the people who bring Marxism back in again. I mean, some of the economists, it's very interesting the ways in which the economists, you know, have turned back to Marx. And I've read two or three articles in the last 5 or 6 years, people saying, just a minute, we mustn't throw Marx away. You know, what Marx had to say about this or Marx had to say about that is a more economistic reintroduction of Marx. It's not much to do with Marx and alienation and class conflict and the socialist revolution, but in order to acknowledge and make sense of globalization and advanced corporate capitalism. By the way, can we have Marx back again? But the political people, I don't think, you know, any mention of Marx, I mean, did the word Marx appear once during the Labour Party conference this year? I very much doubt it. I mean, it is like shouting fire in a crowded theatre, isn't it? Or some such analogy. I mean, it can't be mentioned. No one's allowed to mention it at all. And I think, I mean, there is a lovely book to be written, and I haven't read it yet, and people, I think, have made one or two attempts, but there's a lovely book to read about exactly what the end of that ideological possibility meant to all those people who had had it previously. I mean, we know there are still, if you like, there are still people who are going around proselytizing in the same old way, but they've almost become caricatures. You know, they're almost invited on the talk shows as though they were freaks who, you know, we can sit on the end and they can make a few grimaces and we can all say, what an esoteric creature. But it really is the feeling that it went out of universities as well. I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, we're not just simply talking about, you know, the collapse of interest in Marxism being something that was brought about by the collapse of the Soviet Union or some such facile story. I don't think so. I mean, the universities began to get cold feet. I mean, the universities began to retrench. I mean, I saw it in my own universities, the way in which people had to play down their Marxism. And indeed, you know, you couldn't be seen to be involved in political activity in the ways in which you were in the 60s and 70s. I mean, gradually the new managerial ethos which became in at universities started really prescribing, not to, you know, in an explicit way, but started prescribing exactly what sociology was meant to be and what politics was all about and what economics should be. So I think that people coming out of universities now, if they're coming out of political philosophy courses, out of sociology courses, are going to know far less about Marx, far less exposure, indeed in some cases perhaps no exposure whatsoever. So it is, there is a story to be written about what this has done and how people who find themselves not being able to turn and not being able to meet people and talk in Marxist terms about what's going on in the world, about what on earth they put in the place of it now that ideology is no longer there. I mean, do you remember the plays of Trevor Griffiths? You know, Trevor Griffiths used to put on stage, I can't remember the name of one of his most famous plays, well, I remember the comedians, but I can't remember the name of the, where you would put together five or six people sitting around in a room, largely, and they would engage in a debate. There are other Shavian dramas, you know, in which people, someone would be an old Stalinist, someone would be a Trotskyist, somebody else. But through the arguments that went on, you know, between them about the nature of capitalism, about the nature of this, I mean, you suddenly thought this was a great intellectual debate, you know, and Trevor Griffiths could bring large audiences in to look at this. I mean, can you imagine this sort of thing going on the stage now? People would say, well, what are these ideas? What significance have they got? And poor Trevor Griffiths, I think he was a brilliant writer. I mean, he's hardly had a thing on television. He's hardly had a thing on the stage, as far as I can think, for about the last 15 years. I mean, he was one of our most promising and most interesting writers. But suddenly it's almost as though his subject matter has been taken away. And people say, who's interested in that anymore? And I just want to add to this, because it's something that is related. I mean, I can just tie the New Age bit together, Neil Podrick, with what I was saying, because I just think that debating and arguing is something that you learn how to do. You know, there's a nice book been out recently on the art of conversation and talking about how conversation died. And conversation is defined, you know, in the possibility of people vigorously disagreeing with each other, trying to find grounds for agreement, trying to bring in, you know, empirical data or rations or whatever. Engaging in that debate, having some strong arguments. Now, when I now go to this is just a little story which always illustrates this to me. It was about sort of like 9 months ago, and I was at a dinner party. And somebody said, oh, please, you know, holding up their hands as a particular dish came round. I told you I was a vegetarian, you see. So we sort of sat back and munched a little. I just said, I'm interested to hear what you said, you know, that you're a vegetarian. Why are you a vegetarian? Because I thought it would be quite an interesting discussion to look at the grounds. So I said, what do you mean, why am I vegetarian? So I said, well, you know, I mean, do you feel that sort of animals are not there to be exploited by human beings? Or don't you like the taste of meat? Or, you know, what grounds? She said, it's what I think, you know. And I said, yeah, you've said that, you know, we agree with what you think. But, I mean, you know, why do you think it? She said, well, I'm afraid that's, you know, that's me. That's what I think. I'm sorry, you know. There's no point in you going on at me. This is, you know, this is what I believe. I suddenly began to Just a minute. It was though questioning someone's beliefs had suddenly become tantamount to trying to undermine their identity.
Indeed, yeah.
And one other little story. May I tell you one of the... I remember I was in a debate organised by the Times, and the man who was organising the debate rang me up and said, we were talking about marriage. He said, would you like to argue that marriage is dead or that marriage, as it were, will never die? And I said, well, I don't mind. I said, you know, what speakers have you got? And he said, well, would you mind doing the, you know, marriage is dead and all over? So I said, oh, that's fine. Okay, I'll do that one then. So we went into the debate, and I did this one. Yeah. And then one of the participants in the debate, I won't name her, I mean, silly woman, but anyway, I mean, well-known silly woman, but she suddenly said, oh, she said, very interesting to hear Laurie arguing against marriage. I happen to know that he's married at the moment and had two previous wives. And she looked around, and the audience applauded. I thought, just a minute, have we completely lost the notion of what a debate is about? You know, I mean, is the personal, you know, so absolutely critical that we cannot actually manage to have an argument at a general sort of theoretical argumentative level without you suddenly saying, just a minute, I know what you are deep down, so how can you possibly be saying this? It is the impossibility, really, of somehow separating a body of argument from your deep self and personality.
So do you think... do you think there's been a loss of the art of debate, particularly taught in the sort of educational institutions, or do you think the sort of rise of sort of identity politics and the sort of grievance culture has sort of made the idea of debating sort of offensive and redundant?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think the idea of debate has completely disappeared. I don't know how many universities have got debating societies. I was told the other day that, I mean, the largest single society in contemporary universities is ballroom dancing. You know, and I mean, you know, that's not exactly full of conversation, I shouldn't imagine, really, is it? Because you're actually facing backwards, aren't you? I mean, if you're a woman. But no, I mean, the art. If you look at contemporary universities, the way in which they are now geared against the possibility of debate, I mean, you couldn't structure them in such a way as to deny debate. I mean, it was bad enough. I mean, I used to be teaching in seminar groups of about 7 or 8. I mean, now people are routinely teaching in seminar groups of 14 and 15.
Sure.
That's 14 and 15 people in what is usually about 50 minutes out of the hour by the time people have arrived and left early for their next lecture. 50 minutes divided by 14 people, plus the intervention of the person who's taking it, you're not going to get much vigorous debate going on there. And the decline of the societies, the political societies, which used to be places where people could learn about debating, that's also gone on. I mean, we often lament the decline of trade unions, because trade unions were also places where working class people who had been apprenticed or were growing up within industry debated and argued. I mean, there were sites which were laid aside for argument. But I mean, now universities, now almost, if you imagine that they were in a conspiracy to keep students as quiet as possible, and I think you could even argue that. I mean, Irving Goffman, wonderfully in Asylums, you know, just talked about the ways in which, if any possibilities exist for the owners of institutions to be able to silence their charges, they take it. It's much more easier to manipulate them, you know, don't talk, please, we haven't got time for that, get in a row, stand still, shut your mouth, you know, let's get on with it. And universities now seem like that. I mean, I don't know, I mean, let me throw the question back to you. I mean, I don't know where you went to university. I mean, you look like a De Montfort man to me.
I was a De Montfort man, funnily enough. That's very good. Good heavens. Perhaps we have to talk about Laurie's psychic ability.
It's something I only bring up at dinner parties. But what was your... I don't know how long ago you were there, but you look young enough not to have been there. I mean, you've been there pretty recently. What was it like, the experience of it?
Well, my experience at university was that the entire university was basically in the sort of... in the clutch of the postmodernist theorists.
Yeah.
But what I'm talking about the sort of the idea of the sort of death of debate is what I tend to find. I mean, I love the idea of arguing. I like when I'm with a group of good friends and we're having a drink and an argument starts. I'm like a dog on a scent. It's fantastic. But I tend to come across as being sort of, you know, argumentative and aggressive rather than somebody who likes to debate, and I find people take offence at it.
Yes, and that is doubled up with, isn't it? I mean, there seem to be two concepts which are much employed now, which get it partly right. But we can't use either of them. I mean, one is the idea, really, of dumbing down, and the other is the idea of political correctness. Now, dumbing down and political correctness have both been appropriated by the right. You know, and in some cases, if we talk about dumbing down, I mean, often this is a disguise for a sort of Levisite patrician notion that high art must be protected and that the plebs are taking over and the television's become dreadfully populist, and how dare those people, appalling people who do media studies, try to compare Coronation Street with Hedda Gabler.
Can I just interrupt you a moment and out myself as a study in media studies?
I was going to say that, but I didn't, because this gradually emergent psychic reputation needs to be put to rest immediately. But I do want to talk about dumbing down. I do think that the university experience has dumbed down. I do think what people get out of universities now is considerably less than they got out of universities some years ago. I do think now we're moving towards the 50% participation rate in universities. Those people who go to university are not getting anything they got when there's a 22% participation rate. But the other little ally to that, and I'll just throw this in, but is that political correctness one, because this relates directly to what you were saying about you arguing. I mean, if I do anything that sounds like starting an argument with the place that I work, for example, in the BBC now, well, I really am very, very concerned, because I just feel it'll be reckoned to be bullying, it'll be reckoned to be intimidatory, because I'm older, you know, I'm older than everybody there, I mean, you know, but I mean, I'm older, taller, whatever, you know, and I can easily be accused, in fact, of proselytizing my viewpoint so strongly that someone takes offense at the way that I'm doing it. So although I don't want to buy the whole baggage of political correctness, which has some ridiculous notions in it, you know, then either we should go back to calling people chairman, for example, I mean, there's some of these sillier linguistic things. I mean, okay. But I do think that within there, those ideas that there is dumbing down and that political correctness or something like political correctness has very much interfered with the cut and thrust of normal debate and argument. Particularly in the workplaces used to be great places for argument and debate and talking. And you know, it was one of the things one went in for. You know, you've got to meet a lot of people, you know, and you can have a chance to have a chance. But now you've got to be very, very careful.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, getting back to the universities, it strikes me as something that's a slight issue for us who would self-identify as left, in that there seems to be a conflict between access and quality. And I'm not quite sure how we resolve this. If we're going to say, well, everyone should have access to a third level education, which I absolutely agree with, does that automatically demean or belittle somehow a third level degree?
Well, I mean, of course, people always present that as a trade-off.
Yeah. Again, it seems like a right-wing thing to say,
there is a trade-off, and I don't think there's any way we can rescue the universities. I don't think that, you know, the government is suddenly going to provide, you know, a few hundred billion pounds in order to be able to have five-person seminars, you know, and have individual tutorials or anything like that at all. I mean, what is going to happen is that more and more universities, you know, including the elite universities, are going to be really finding themselves following the other universities in just being degree factories. But I do think that what it does mean is we need to have places outside universities, you know, where debates can occur. And I do think it's interesting. I mean, I haven't measured this, but I would suggest to you there's pretty good empirical evidence in the last 10 years that all sorts of arenas have been opening up where people can have debates that they didn't previously have before. I mean, I certainly don't want to push the success of, say, something like the Institute of Ideas, because I'm a little bit worried about the sort of informing ideology. But, you know, that extraordinary success in holding very, very large conferences several times a year, attracting not just hundreds, but thousands of people along to take part in 3 days of debating. And if you go to other parts of London, other parts of the country, you'll suddenly find debating societies are coming back in again. I mean, I've been chairing 2 series of debates, ongoing debates. I'm starting another series just next week, a series of debates organised around the Oxford University Press's very short introductions. Now, I think it would suggest that 10, 15 years ago, nobody would come out to watch a debate. But there seem to be many more people who really do want to come out and begin to talk. And you see that even in, let's take book clubs, you know, the much sort of like derided, sometimes laughed at. I'm not quite certain why they're patronised so much. But, you know, in the Richard and Judy, or the success in getting book clubs going and getting people talking to each other. I mean, this is really, I think, impossible 10, 15 years ago. So I think there are signs of people almost beginning to say, Yeah, just a minute. I'm almost suffering from a talk decrement. There's a funny little, just to throw this in, I can remember a funny little social psychological experiment by some American man who decided that people spoke for around about the same amount of time each day. You know, they somehow had a notion of how much talking they should do. And if they didn't manage to do that talking during the day, they'd get on the phone when they got home at 11:30, you know, and ring up a mate and do a bit of talking. You know, it was a quantum theory of talking. So it's as though, and this is an absurd proposition, I know, but it was almost as though I have a quantum theory of talking, and many people are now suffering from such a deficit, such a decrement in the amount that they talk, that they've just got to go out somewhere and debate with other people face to face. Face to face is important as well, because all those ways in which you avoid face to face conversation, because if you're talking about arguing, you know, I'd suggest to you that really arguing over a mobile telephone really is not possible. Sure. I've been arguing by email, you know, across...
It's simply not because you can't slam it down.
No, that's right.
Push the button rather aggressively. It's not the same.
But all of these, far from facilitating communication, are ways in which, you know, reduce the amount of interpersonal communication that people have, the number of face-to-face opportunities. And I think that face-to-face conversation is something that has to be cultivated. I mean, let me just take some of these, you know, some of these people who are arriving at university, and I was terrible, I would wander down to the senior common room, you know, and say, God almighty, I spent a bloody hour trying to get someone to say something, you know, and we would all sit there saying, God almighty. I can remember one seminar going in, and I was talking about Max Weber's Protestant ethic and the way in which this could be related to development of Western capitalism, and I said, sort of sitting there, and I said, okay, would anybody like to have a shot at telling me about, you know, what Max Weber had to say about the relationship between the Protestant ethic and, you know, silence, and I said, well, okay, well, let's take it on a little tiny bit. Would anybody like to have a shot at just perhaps describing the Protestant ethic? You know, I mean, forget about capitalism for silence. And I said, well, you know, how about capitalism? Anyone like to have a shot at capitalism? You know? And I mean, I sort of joked in the senior comment, and it wasn't quite true, but I said, you know, it suddenly occurred to me that all I could do to get them talking was ask them if there's anyone in the room who could spell Max Weber's first name. You know, I just thought, you know, I've got to get you speaking. But then I thought, listen, you're not allowed this position. I mean, if you look at the history of silence of sort of an 18-year-old now, I mean, if you look, I mean, now, I had someone on the program the other day, I was sort of saying, so they were talking about vertical drinking and the loud music in pubs, yeah. And I sort of felt, God, I'm getting a bit old here, and I said, well, you know, I can't. They said, well, of course you can't stand it, but I mean, you know, I mean, it's there for a very good purpose, all the loud music in pubs and all the vertical drinking and everything like that. So I said, well, you know, why is that? And they said, well, you know, because the brewers know full well that if you're, you know, that if you're talking, you're not drinking as quickly as you could. I mean, in the same way that they start bringing you shooters and slammers around on trays so you don't have to queue up the bar, that's to get you drinking a little bit more so you don't have to waste all that time standing at the bar getting a drink. So in the same way, you pump up the music and no one can speak, all you can do is just stand in front of each other and drink. So I suddenly thought, you know, that's one thing that's going on. But also, you know, the smaller and smaller households, so many households with just one kid stuck in their room. You know, yeah. I mean, you know, when you think about it, I sometimes say to audiences, you know, look, do you remember the time when, you know, you sent your child to their room as a punishment? Taking them out of their room now is the punishment. The decline of family meals. There's no familial conversation going on there. So there's not much conversation going on outside. I did a study with someone who looked at drink and binge drinkers. You're looking at the clock. I need to stop. No, but you know, but looking at these, and these binge drinkers didn't have any consistent friends. All they did was mates that they met up with on the night they went out when they got absolutely completely pissed, and then they perhaps met up the next morning and talked about what a good time they'd had. But they wouldn't see each other during the week. They didn't know where they lived. They didn't talk about their jobs. It's a very, very odd sort of almost like parasocial relationships, you know, not friendships. So, I mean, maybe I'm just being an old man and regretting, as it were, the arrival of the new. But I just think there are times when we just simply have to say something has occurred and it's something bad.
But at the same time, there are record number of people going to university, and the government's targets are for that to be even higher.
Yes.
So how do those things correlate?
Well, I mean, it'll go on being higher and higher, but I think that, as it were, the degree will be gradually devalued. It won't mean so much. It'll come to mean rather like, you know, if you say, have you got a degree? And people say, of course I've got a degree, you know, and everybody's got a bloody degree, haven't they? You know, has anybody without a degree? I thought everyone had one now. I mean, so it will be devalued. I mean, we're already getting this grade drift. I mean, now so many people got firsts at Liverpool University this year that people are saying, the first's been devalued, so you'll have to have starred first. They'll be devalued. I mean, you have double starred first. You know, all sorts of ways of trying to indicate... I mean, I thought for a long time the business of handing out even degree classes is an absurd way of going about it. I mean, if you've ever been involved in an examiner's meeting, you know the arbitrary justice. When I wander around, someone says, I'm afraid I only got a 2-2. And I say, well, I think it is unfortunate you only got a 2-2. On another day, another morning, if someone had spoken up for you, someone added one mark on here, you'd have got the 2-1. I mean, it is a way in which academics constantly feel powerful because this is the one time they can really sit in judgment over their minions and say, I'm sorry, you may not getting away with this, you know, you're getting a 2-2. It's quite silly. And I think universities universities already are being devalued, the undergraduate experience is being devalued. And I can only think, really, you know, we're going to be talking about more and more postgraduate stars. You've already got, I read the other day, starred PhDs already.
Really?
Starred PhDs in order to distinguish them from the multitude of other ordinary PhDs. So you're going to be called, you know, Dr. Taylor rather than simply Doctor.
Well, Laurie mentioned that we were looking at the clock, and we were, because it's time for the interval, and Laurie's brought along a song, which he's going to explain why he brought along.
It's very funny, isn't it? Really, sort of like it is it's almost the ultimate in vanity to bring along a record which has a message for you and so on. It sounds like the sort of worst excesses of Desert Island Disc. But this is an extraordinary. It's just a little tiny story. It won't take a second. Is that all right? Can I tell you a little story? But some years ago, that must be around about 1970. I think it was 1971. I was at York, teaching at York, and desperately interested in jazz. I love jazz, but I mean, you know, loving jazz in York was really, they just didn't go together. You couldn't find any jazz in York. I mean, the number of appalling venues one went to, you know, you crept up the stairs at the local pub into a room with a bicycle leaning against the wall, you know, and there'd be a sort of like a little group of people, two of whom really couldn't play and one of whom could play a bit, doing their best. It was sad, sad days. But then one day, my mate Terry came to me. He said, Laurie, he ran the local jazz club, you know, I mean, the local jazz club, there was hardly anything, but he said you've heard of Joe Harriott? I said, yeah, well, the fantastic, you know, Jamaican alto player. He said, yeah, Joe Harriott, yeah. I said, what about him? He said, he's coming to York. So I said, what do you mean he's coming to York? He said, well, he's like got a letter, you know, saying, hello, I'm Joe Harriott, you know, would you like me to come to York and play? So I thought, I mean, you know, it was a bit like, sort of like, to me, a bit like, I mean, he was the really greatest there was in Britain. Very, very exciting, extraordinarily innovative, you know, really quite avant-garde, quite difficult, but sort of just wonderful. And I thought, it's like suddenly receiving a notice saying that, you know, Coltrane was going to be turning up at the station, you know, the next day. So we dashed around and found people who could perhaps, you know, play the drums, perhaps, but, you know, what could we have to provide a band for him? Anyway, he arrived, and he was a lovely figure. I mean, dressed, always dressed in a completely black suit, with a nylon shirt which he assiduously washed out every night. He was not well. He had a sort of hump on his back, which later turned out to be a cancerous tumour, which eventually killed him just 2 years later after this meeting. Now, he was down on his luck, but he was far too proud a man for you ever to say, Christ, you know, what's happened to you? I mean, you couldn't say that to him, you know. And he came out to these York pubs, and he played his heart out. He told musicians what to do, how to change, what to do this. This is the thing they're going to do. He'd hum it to them. He'd help them out. He'd show them. And in little tiny back rooms of pubs, you know, one sat and watched Joe stand in his black suit, his washed out nylon thing, stand up, you know, he had a very sort of like noble face, and he just played this instrument. I mean, probably played it like nobody else, you know, no other person. I doubt if any alto player. And of course, what had happened, I mean, goodness knows what had happened, whether or not he behaved badly on somewhere, he hadn't paid his musicians' union's dues, I don't think anyone knows. I've never really read an account of it. But it was symptomatic of that sort of generation, because, I mean, his great fellow player, the trumpeter Sheikh Keane, you know, who was also West Indian, I mean, these Caribbean musicians who were around in the 50s, late 50s, who came over and were playing, and they also had a sort of Caribbean playing bass with them, Coleridge Good playing bass with them, but they were sort of ignored. They were too far ahead of the field. And when you listen to them now and you say, well, good heavens, you know, look, this is what was going on, you know, this was what was being played in 1970. So this is a particular track from the Joe Harriott Quintet called Free Form, and this opening one is Formation. But listen to the speed and the intensity and the modernism of this. Can you imagine? This was being played in Britain, you know, in the 70s.
Welcome back. You're listening to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM with Padre Greedy and me, Neil Denny. We're talking to Laurie Taylor, and you've just heard the Joe Harriet Quintet, and that was a formation.
Laurie, I wanted to take it back, maybe. This is terrible, I'm dragging everything back to Marxism as I did in the first half. But you, in the 70s, I'm not sure in the 60s, were you, but yeah. Certainly in the 70s, were involved in the International Socialists, now the Socialist Working Party, and along with a lot of people who would be friends of this program, were involved in the International Socialists. What was the particular draw of the IS in the 70s that it doesn't seem to have now?
Well, the draw was, I mean, very simple in the context of what we were talking about before. The draw was that IS had some of the most interesting, active, original minds who were at the university as members. Gwyn Williams, who was a Marxist, he wasn't a member of the International Socialists at the time, but Gwyn Williams was a Marxist professor of history who was working there. We also had Peter Sedgwick was there, and people on the left will remember Peter Sedgwick. I mean, he tragically died some years ago, but Peter Sedgwick was a wonderfully astringent critic of the fads for Langian psychiatry in the 60s. I mean, Peter was wonderfully, wrote some marvellous pieces really attacking some of this Langian nonsense. And there was a guy called Nigel Harris, who's now a professor at the at SOAS, I think. These people, they were bright. Also, we had Bob Looker in the politics department as well, and some of the brightest students. But the fact was, of course, when I started teaching at York in round about 1965, that the people coming to university then, the new universities, coming to do sociology in the new universities, were often people coming who had already been members of groups. You know, they'd been members of SLL, or they'd been members of the Young Communist League. You know, they had a political history. So the fascination of this group, this particularly, we'd had all sorts of people with different types of left-wing past, but they all wanted to debate. They all wanted to discuss. Now, I mean, some of the discussions were positively theological in content, you know, exactly what happened at Kronstadt, you know, and the extent to which Trotsky was responsible. But nevertheless, you know, you had to go away and read. You know, you went away and read in order to manage the argument, in order to turn the tables on your opponent. So although there was an IS line, it was really a very, very diffuse line. It was really rather like the Catholic Church. You know, there were bog standard, you know, people out selling papers and with, you know, banners saying smash the bosses now. But also in the same way that the Catholic Church also had sort of Jesuitical theology and opportunities for philosophical debate, so IS did in those days. And indeed the journal of the IS group, International Socialism, then, was a pretty good theoretical journal. I mean, there were good people writing in it, and they weren't necessary. So that you would get, for example, I mean, Sedgwick wrote a wonderful critique of Marcuse there. I mean, enormously influential, powerful critique, extremely good. And he also, and I remember him doing something very good on Orwell as well. So this was an intellectual hothouse. There wasn't anywhere else in the university. I mean, so we'd have meetings of 40 or 50 people, and, you know, there would be. We'd turn to how many papers had we sold outside Roundtree's, the previous week, and who was going to try and organise the Tenants Association, bring the tenants out on rent strike, which they never somehow came out on York. I don't know, we never succeeded in raising their class consciousness during the 9 years I was in IS. But nevertheless, before that, we'd have a debate. And it was almost as though you could see, I mean, ideas were infirmed. I can remember being above the Lowther pub in York, where we held our regular meetings, and I can remember a woman standing up. I can remember Barbara Crowther. I remember her standing up and saying, could I just make an announcement, please? And we all said, what announcement? She said, you know that in a quarter of an hour's time, when the meeting ends, that we all go down to the bar and look at the football. So we all, that's what we do. That's our routine. Of course, that's how we behave. She said, well, we're not doing that now. She said, the women in the room now, we're going off and have our own separate meeting, and we won't be coming down to watch the football. And with that, all the women stood up. And I said, Christ, I've just seen feminism born, you know. And, you know, I just to watch feminism collide with International Socialism, you know. It was really rather watching, you know, the whole gay revolution colliding with International Socialism. So I mean, this is where things were happening. It was where it was exciting. But the excitement began to fizzle out as it became more and more doctrinaire. And when one came across some of the more profound ideologues in the movement, the Chris Harmons, if you like, of the world, or indeed, one has to say, the Tony Cliffs of the world, you know, that you began to feel, no, just a minute, this is beginning to remind me of the sort of totalitarian ideological system called Catholicism, which I left behind some time ago.
You just raised an interesting point there, that to join a group like that and be able to engage in a debate, one of the things you had to do was to read and sort of have the knowledge. And we were talking about the concept of dumbing down in the first half. And I wonder if that's something that's been lost because there's been a loss of, you know, sort of that sort of political movements, that perhaps, you know, the idea that to engage in a debate with anybody else, because there's this idea of the equivalence of other people's ideas, so your view on something is equal to my view, even if, you know, I'm completely and utterly empirically wrong. And so the idea that you have to have some sort of body of knowledge behind you before you're entitled to engage in a debate seems to have disappeared.
Well, yes, it has. I mean, that again has disappeared in the idea of constant assertion that, you know, what I believe is somehow part of my essence, and the only proof I need that is that I feel it. I think that's a concern with the validity of people's feelings. I mean, as a sociology, I want to sort of deny people any special say about their own feelings. You know, I'm not prepared really for people to say, well, I'm sorry, that's what I feel. You know, I say, tell me about the feeling. Let's analyse the feeling. What sort of feeling is this? Where does it come from? What's it related to? So I think what you say is right. We're talking about the reduction of arenas of contestation, you know, between people, about the reduction of those possibilities. And also, as you say, I mean, the idea that you read before you speak, that you do have some knowledge, and also that you, I mean, that's the great thing. I mean, I went along to see a book club, you know, a little book club in operation, and of course there, that is premised. We can't come along and join. There's no point in coming along unless you've read the bloody book. I mean, whatever the book is. So you come along, you read the book, and you don't go in for some postmodernist textual analysis of it. I mean, you say, I like the bit where this and then, but I mean, good heavens, you've all got the same text. And of course, we all had the same texts in IS, whichever volumes of Marx they were, or whether it was the 18th Brumaire, or whether it was, you know, the earlier essays on alienation, whatever, we knew the texts. And once you know the text, you can say, well, you know, do you get anywhere? I mean, don't you can keep going round in circles? Isn't there a, in Freudian terms, a narcissism of small differences, where you're always elaborating your differences with rival groups? Yes, to an extent, but I just like the practice in being able to do it. I'd like to have had a good argument about vegetarianism, you know. Could I just please have a go, you know? Why? But so that's lost.
I mean, you say that, I mean, once you approach the Chris Harmons and Tony Cliffs of this world, the cadre, so to speak, of the IS, that you became increasingly disillusioned. Was there an actual point where you thought, well, sod this, I'm off?
Yes, it was.
Or did you not renew?
Well, to tell the true story, we had a worker. A worker joined the group, and those of you, if you've been in radical left-wing groups, when a worker arrives, you know, call. I mean, all the rest of us were academics and students. So this academic, who's a man called Dunlop Griffiths, he worked at... out at the rather controversial power stations, I think, out at Drax, you know, on the on the northeast coast there. But he was a shop steward there, and we thought, God, I mean, you know, we got a shop steward worker. So we would have these sort of debates, and then we'd sort of say, well, now we've got a worker, how are things at Drax? And he'd say, well, things are going, you know, they're not too good, the electricians aren't very happy, and there's some danger, you know, and people are going into the furnace. So we'd say, well, look, we must do something about that, you know, can't you organise, we'll come over, we've got posters, we'll produce pamphlets, you know. And as it went on, I could see, you know, their excitement to get him to try and call a strike, to try and sort of create a bit of mayhem so they could really feel that they were making an effective intervention. And of course, what one could see was they were really appropriating his struggle. And one night, I remember he was sitting there, and I'd become sort of friendly with him. He drank in the bar, and he used to complain. He said, oh, do you find it a bit rich? He said, when a, you know, senior lecturer in politics, you know, start telling me how I should behave, you know, in my own power station. So, you know, but one night, I remember he came, and any questions about this? Because they produced these leaflets to hand out, absolutely true, to hand out to Drax, and one of them said, smash the bosses now. And he said, look, he said, I don't, we don't really call them bosses. He said, we don't use the word boss very much nowadays. And they said, oh, no, well, the word boss is the correct word to use. I mean, these people are bosses, you've got to realise that, you know. And he said, we tend to call them, you know, like managers. And they said, but this is an insidious way in which capitalism works. You know, people were saying, I mean, managers, I mean, that really denies what they're doing. In fact, they're in charge of you. In fact, they're ruling your life. You know, they're doing, you know, calling them managers is a nice soft euphemism. You know, these people are bosses. And I remember going away to the bar with him afterwards. He said, I can't stand much more of this. He said, it really is getting a bit laughable. He said, I know what's going on here. He said, all these academics trying to get off on the idea of a real workers' strike where they could march down the road, where there'd be people called pickets and a few braziers maybe, you know, and we would have done it, we'd have produced it, you know, we could go to London and say, look what we've done in York, you know, we've raised consciousness at Drax Power Station and they've all come out. So this man, who had a good sense of humour, and he was able to sort of satirise what if you might like call the operational side of International Socialist, so much that, I don't know, laughter drew me away. Doesn't laughter really, in the end, often draw you away from certain sorts of disciplines or ideologies that you've imprisoned yourself within, and someone then starts to laugh at you effectively and you try to fight back the smile, and then gradually you go, okay, you got me there, you're right, yes, you're right.
Let me draw us away from this particular topic then, and something I want to raise before we run out of time. Laurie, you've recorded a television programme for Channel 5, which is about the sort of apocalyptic millenarian cults. Tell us about this.
Well, I just wanted to try to talk to people who believed that the end of the world was nigh. Because I was fascinated by how you lived if you really believed the end of the world was nigh. How did you get on with your life? I mean, it's not totally dissimilar from a book that I wrote a long, long time ago with my good friend Stan Cohen called Psychological Survival, in which we looked at people who were in prison for 30 years, and we simply asked, how do you manage to be in prison for 30 years? What do? You know, do you stay with your wife outside? Do you end the relationship with your kids? What do? Do you go silent? Do you study? Whatever. So this is a bit like that. I wanted to know, you know...
It's also like being an atheist as well, because people say, if you're an atheist, what's the point? You know, what have you got to live for? And if you're such a religious believer that you think the end of the world is nice, it seems pretty similar. But sorry,
sorry
for interrupting.
Right.
Please carry on.
So I went along. I mean, because we haven't got all that much time, but I spoke to one very excellent guy who'd written a book about this. I should give him a name check, but I've forgotten his name. But anyway, he was he'd written this book, and he had done a much more exhaustive study than I did. I mean, television, as you know nowadays, is so cheap, you never do an exhaustive study of anything. You know, it's another aspect of dumbing down, isn't it? The disappearance of truly investigative journalism and truly investigative television. You know, it's now reduced to people going around exposing people who don't wash their lavatories. You know, that's what stands in for it. But anyway, I mean, the point about this programme, this man said, well, it's very interesting that he'd interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people who might be called apocalyptic, who really believed the world was going to come to an end very soon, you know, and they hadn't really made any provisions. He'd say to them, have you got any, you know, extra rations in? Because, I mean, you know, if there's these appalling things, you know, going to come in the night, you know.
You might need a few tins of beans or something.
That's right. So, now, this applied, you see, what I was putting together were two groups. I was putting together the ecologists, you know, the Astronomer General, all those people who say we've only got about 20 or 30 years to go. I was putting there, yes, Martin Rees, exactly. I was putting those people together with the religious apocalypse and trying to see whether or not the language in which they spoke about the end and about how near it was, you know, and what was similar. And of course it has become remarkably similar, because what fascinated me was how the ecologists, the extreme ecologists, wanted to draw upon the language of like the Book of Revelations in order to press home on other people the proximity of the end of the world and to talk about the end of the world. And they often didn't specify which bits of the world would end, or, you know, which bits of what would happen here. But, you know, just there was no hope. We were doomed. There was nothing else coming along. And so what I did, just went to see different people almost in succession, you know, to see a Rastafarian, and talk about the apocalypse there, which is rather interesting. Of course, for them, rather like Jehovah's Witnesses, natural disasters, you know, are evidence that the end of the world is arriving, you know. And indeed, of course, for the Rastafarians, so I go, you know, you're looking, how long have we got anyway? I mean, the Rastafarians, in a way, of course, the Christ has already arrived. The second coming has already come, you know, and the Emperor of Ethiopia, Haile Selassie.
We are in end days now.
And Haile Selassie is still alive. Okay, so rather interesting, when they see a disaster, this is actually the end of the world. So I talked to him, you know, about tsunami, and he said, "Oh yeah, no, that's the killing off of the wicked." And I said, "Yeah, killing off the wicked?" He said, "Oh yeah, no." I said, "What? I mean, but these are thousands of people. You know, they can't all be wicked." He said, "No, you'll find one or two have been saved by clinging onto trees. You know, they're the people without sin. You know, but of course, the Jehovah's Witnesses, they collect atrocities. You know, they collect another great air crash. You know, another. Yeah. You know, this all signs. But the ecologists are doing exactly the same. You know, they're wandering around saying tsunami. That's it. That's the sign. You know, we're coming to the end of the world." So what fascinated me was conflating these, putting them together. So at certain points, I think, in the film, it's almost difficult to know whether the person speaking is someone who scientifically investigated the possibility of the world coming to end, or someone who's only religiously invoked the possibility relying on the Book of Revelations.
It is interesting. I mean, you know, there was, you know, after Hurricane Katrina and after, well, less so at the time, but certainly Hurricane Katrina is like this is entirely down to global warming. But it then failed to take into account that we did have hurricanes several hundred years ago, and quite a lot of them as well. You know, or, you know, the tsunami was caused by a massive earthquake, which signified something, but the Lisbon earthquake 300 years ago, was that the same thing?
I mean, Voltaire using these sort of like natural disasters as a way, in fact, to attack the church's absurd explanation of them. But now, you know, I mean, Voltaire would be, you know, it's very difficult for Voltaire to get a voice in and say, just a minute, you know, stop attributing this to God's, the world's fallen out of disfavor with God. You know, he'd be fighting against it.
Yeah.
And you do need to fight for rationalism in those areas.
Mm-hmm. You don't actually know when this program's going to be broadcast, do you?
They won't
tell
me, no. I mean, somebody did tell me, they said, oh, no, they're not putting it out in June and July, as we thought, because it was the World Cup. They didn't want it to be a show for the World Cup. But now I'm beginning to think, I wonder if they're lying to me. I wonder if they, they don't like the bloody program, you know. I mean, with television, I mean, you know, you just have to nod, really, with television. I don't know, it's very difficult to know why people do it any longer. But it's so unsatisfactory compared to radio. Good God, we've sat here for a bloody hour and talked. Isn't it extraordinary? I've talked.
Well, you can hear Laurie on Radio 4 regularly at the moment, on talking aloud, which is on when, Laurie?
Thinking aloud, on Wednesday
thinking
afternoon.
Thinking aloud, I beg your
doesn't
pardon.
Matter, really. 4 o'clock every Wednesday afternoon. The only radio programme, the listening figure of -2. Not only does nobody listen, but two people happen to already go around criticising it.
Well, it only remains for us to say thanks very much for taking the time to come on the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Patrick.
You can find our website at www.littleatoms.com. We're back in 2 weeks on the 13th of October with the writer Francis Ween, and that show is going to be broadcast between 7 and 8 on the Friday night for 1 week only. So thanks for listening. We'll be right back.